The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
One of my favorite poems, it was John F. Kennedy's favorite poem. He had it read at his inauguration. The road less traveled by. Two roads diverged in the woods, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Now, that's a beautiful poem. It speaks worlds about the Jewish perspective, about the fact that we're on a journey, that we're attempting to reach a goal, and that sometimes we have difficulties along the road, detours, obstacles, and we have to make some difficult decisions. How do you know when you've arrived at such an obstacle? How do you know whether you're making the right decision? Sometimes decisions are easy because there is no decision. I'll give you an example. Just yesterday, I walked outside of the old city. I usually leave the car for my wife. We have three children. And I walked outside of the old city at actually a normal hour. I was pleased. I was going to get home in time for dinner, spend some time with the children. And I got to where I'd parked my car, and something was amiss. It wasn't there. And you have that moment of indecision. Maybe there's something wrong with you. And you kind of look around, and people walk by, and they know. You don't know yet, but they know. And they're looking at your face, and they know. And you're trying to figure, maybe you parked it in a different place. Maybe this isn't the place. You look for glass on the floor, and there's nothing there. Now, you can laugh, or you can cry, but your car is still going to be stolen. There's no decision to make. There's nothing to do. Sometimes you have events in your life that are much more difficult. Decisions, they're not quite so simple. I'll give you an example. When I was, this is about 8 years ago, right at the beginning of the Intifada. This is 1988. We found ourselves on patrol in Gaza, the Gaza Strip. It was about 3 months after the start of the Intifada. I want you to know I spent a good amount of time in Lebanon. I don't ever recall a period that was as hot and as risky as the period that we had that month in Gaza. And it was especially difficult because it was my first milouim. It was my first reserve duty. And I was commanding soldiers who were twice my own age, who had entered the army when it was for me a good year for milk. And that's an awesome responsibility, because the decisions that you make affect the lives not just of your men, but these are family men. They have wives, children waiting for them at home. And every day was a new adventure. And I never knew what was waiting for me. And I remember one particular day, we were on patrol. And I had done patrols in the Gaza Strip before when I was in the regular service, but that was before the Intifada. And we used to do three-man walking patrols. When I got to this particular reserve duty, because it was a few months after the Intifada, so they had decided that all foot patrols had to be 12 men. In Lebanon, we had done 12-man patrols. So it was an amazing feeling to realize that here you were in the middle of Israel and you were doing 12-man patrol. We walked around a corner on patrol in a refugee camp called Jabalia. There were about 500 people waiting for us. Men, women, children, Palestinian flags, burning tires. I mean, you've seen the pictures. And I would say that the distance, ultimately, between us and them was about the length of this hall. And they were a little ways up the street. And I walk around, and we're on this patrol. And there's a way you walk on patrol. You walk in two lines, one on this side of the street, one on that side of the street. There's a whole different way of patrolling when you're in what's called Lashab, Lechima B'Shetach Banui, fighting in a built-up area. And there were all sorts of rules and regulations we had to memorize. The first time that I was ever in a situation where we were dealing with a civilian population, at least not in a war zone. And this side of the patrol is covering the rooftops for that side, and that side is covering the rooftops for this side, and the people in back are looking back, and the people in front are looking back. And, you know, because of the nature of things, you're a little tense. You don't really know quite what to do. You're trained that if someone fires at you, you hit the floor, do a roll, and fire back. It's not so simple when you're in the middle of a refugee camp. There are 500 people, and they're screaming and yelling and chanting and singing and whatever else it is. Now, the standard operating procedure, because the Israeli army was incredibly unprepared for these events at that time, was to call in reinforcements. You would call the battalion. They later decided this was the worst thing you could possibly do, but we didn't know that then. You would call the battalion. You would tell them there are 500 individuals who bear us some ill will, and we'd like some help. And then you wait until they send reinforcements. And then the idea is that you charge at them from one direction. Another unit, the main force of the battalion, charges from another direction. You shoot some gas. You allow them somewhere to run. And the theory is that if they see two groups of people running at them and they can run another way, they'll all run away. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But that was the rule. Now the problem with this theory is that you have to wait 5 or 10 minutes until your reinforcements arrive. Which you can imagine is less than a pleasant experience. And it took about a couple of minutes, and the people in the crowd spotted us. And we had six, they have these shields that you carry, and they're helmets with shields. Yeah, I'll never get the hang of this, long as I live. And they're helmets with shields that they give you that are supposed to protect you. And they begin to throw rocks and bottles and stones and whatever else it is. And this is not a political discussion. And at one point, there were a group of boys who sort of walked in front of the crowd and wanted to get somebody's goat. And they started screaming out things in Arabic and making all sorts of rude gestures. Now, I had a few soldiers who spoke Arabic quite fluently, which was not a good thing, because they understand what these boys were yelling about their families and their relatives and their body parts. There was one particular boy who started yelling in Hebrew, "Why don't you throw down your gun and come out here and meet me man to man?" Now, you have to understand the Middle Eastern mentality. For some of the guys in my unit, Buzaglo, Sharabi, you know, men from North African countries, this was not an easy experience. And I'm watching these men get angrier and angrier and redder as these kids are yelling names at them and epithets about their daughters and their sisters and their mothers and everything else. And you can imagine what's going through my mind. All I want is that the battalion should get there and everybody should go home safe and sound. Nobody should get hurt. Nobody should end up in a court-martial. And I'm telling everybody, chadal, chadal, afchad lo yore, nobody should fire, nobody should shoot gas, nobody should shoot rubber bullets. And you're blissfully unprepared because the things that you have at your disposal, you don't really have that much at your disposal. There was a group of about 20 or 30 guys, and after about 5 minutes of this, all of a sudden, they decided that they could get away with this. What made them decide this, I'm not sure to this day. But they broke into a run and started running at us. I remember one of them, he was probably the ringleader, he had a huge 2x4 with nails sticking out of the end of it. And he's swinging it around his head, screaming at the top of his lungs. Another one of them is carrying a huge Palestinian flag and they're running at you. Now, you don't have the opportunity to sit down with a panel of generals and have a discussion as to what you should do. You have a couple of guys who are always carrying live ammunition. You have somebody who's always carrying a federal gas grenade sort of in a special rifle. Someone else is carrying rubber bullets and whatever is at your disposal. And you're supposed to know where each person is and what they have. So you don't have time to think about this. And you have about 3 seconds. So I told the guy who had rubber bullets in his rifle that he should go down on one knee and he should fire. Now you have to understand, rubber bullets, even though it sounds nice, you're not allowed to fire rubber bullets at the time. I think it was under 70 meters. If I'm not mistaken, 50 meters. Because if you fire a rubber bullet, it's really not a bullet, it's like a pellet. It's like a group of pellets. They're like little miniature hockey pucks. And they come out in a line, and they basically hit a person supposedly wherever they hit him, in the chest hopefully, and they knock him over. But if you fire this under the proper range, you can kill somebody. If you fired a rubber bullet at somebody at this range, you'd kill them. You're killing a civilian. And for all intents and purposes, you're killing a civilian who's involved in a peaceful demonstration. Go tell the news and the courts and the press that it wasn't a peaceful demonstration. And you could easily argue that it was a peaceful demonstration. Anyway, so this guy fires. And I offer up a silent prayer. And it hits this guy full in the chest, knocks him over. Everybody sort of falters. We start firing gas. Two guys pick this guy up. Later they explained to me that they would wrap their chests in newspapers to protect them against this sort of thing. And they'd run off. Now, once this sort of thing happens, there are standard operating procedures, and you begin to run after them. And sure enough, the crowd breaks into a crowd, and everybody starts to run. And that's exactly what you want. And your men know that you run a certain bit, and that's it. And this would have been great if the story ended there. Because we did what we were supposed to do. They did, thank God, what they were supposed to do. It was a good story for them, a good story for us. Life is over. We can go back. We have something to talk about over coffee. Except that there was one wise guy. There's always one wise guy. This wise guy, I have to tell you, till the day I die, I will thank Hashem. I still to this day don't know how this worked out the way it worked out. We're 12 soldiers and we're running. And in theory, you're supposed to be aware of everything that's going around you at all times. There was a guy with an axe who somehow got separated from this whole group. And he came up behind one of my men. One of my men in the back had a heavy radio on, so he was running slower. And he wasn't looking behind him. And there was nobody guarding his rear, as you normally do in a patrol, because everybody was watching what was going on in front and making sure that nobody did anything. And this guy with an axe all of a sudden starts screaming, Allahu Akbar, and shoves this axe into this soldier's back. Now, as luck would have it, at the last instant, somebody yelled something, and I'm not sure to this day, he noticed it, and he bent over. And the axe embedded itself in the radio. And that's how I found him when I got there about 30 seconds later. Someone grabbed this guy, another guy grabbed this guy, everybody surrounded him. By this point, all the rest of them had gotten away. We just caught a guy in the middle of Gaza who had attempted to kill one of my men with an axe. Now, there's standard procedures for this. You don't arrest a guy out in the street. It was considered risky. You can cause another riot. So you take him off very peacefully to the side, and you blindfold him, and you tie up his arms, and then he's taken off to wherever he's taken off, and he's, you know, put into prison, and he goes to court and trial and whatever else. So that's what we did. We took him off to a side alley, and we sat him down, blindfolded him, tied up his hands, told him not to move, not to get up, called battalion. The radio, by some miracle, still worked. Called battalion. And they said they would send somebody. Half of them were already there anyway. While we're waiting for this to happen, and you can imagine my adrenaline is pumping at 200 miles an hour, I've got 11 men who've just been through, I guess you could call it a surreal experience, to say the least. And this guy, who came this close to dying, who can still feel the weight of an axe plunging into radio on his back, walks over to this prisoner, this Arab, this Palestinian, sitting on the ground, blindfolded, with his hands tied behind his back, and starts to scream at him. Now, I won't repeat what he started to scream at him. I will tell you I can completely identify and understand what he screamed at him. You whatever! You think you're gonna do it? He starts yelling at him. And everybody else is standing around, and they start yelling at him. And this guy, all of a sudden, takes a machzanit, which is a cartridge, out of his pouch, and says, Ani alecha, I'll show you what you try to do to me. I have three children. Slams the guy on the head with the machzanit, with the cartridge. Now understand, on the one hand, this is a guy who just tried to kill one of your men. So I can understand his emotion. And you have to understand, for me, this was a new unit. I was all of, 24, 25. These guys have been together, many of them, for 20, 30 years. This particular guy was 2 years away from finishing reserve duty. He'd lived through the Yom Kippur War, the Six-Day War, the Lebanon War, to get killed in the streets of the Gaza Strip. So I can understand where he's coming from. On the other hand, here's a prisoner. He's tied. He's blindfolded. Can't hit a prisoner. So what do? You've got 11 soldiers, angry men, justifiably angry men. You are in the middle of the Gaza Strip, and you know that you can get away with whatever you do. Nobody is going to say anything. And although I don't know personally of such stories, I've heard of such stories, but you could do pretty much anything you want. He was injured in the course of capture, and I could understand where they were coming from. On the other hand, you are the officer, and it's your responsibility. Now, you don't have a long time to think about this. This is an incredible decision. This guy will probably get put into prison, and for all you know, he'll get released. In fact, I'm willing to bet I never followed up on this particular person. I'm willing to bet in the course of the last 5-6 years, he'll be released. For all I know, this person, having been released, went and killed somebody again. So if I let my men kill this guy, I might be saving someone's life. On the other hand, he's a prisoner. What does that do to me as a human being? If I let a prisoner that's caught under my command get hit. So there are army regulations, and there are reasons for army regulations. So I said, Afkhad lo noten makot. Nobody hits this guy. And a couple of the guys start yelling at me. I said, listen, you want to sneak into the prison? You want to be the ones to escort him to jail when he's under somebody else's command? You want to beat him up? Great. You want to come back after your reserve duty? Find him, beat him up? Great. Maybe I'll join you. Fine. But right now, I'm the officer in charge. And if something happens to him, they're not going to come to you. They're going to come to me? I can't do it. And this guy lifts up the cartridge, and again, he says, I'll show you how you can do it. Don't worry about it. And thank goodness at this point, one of the other guys say, no, Alta Celo, he's a young officer, let him be, Yebeseder, and they get into a whole discussion, and then a car from the battalion shows up. And life comes back to normal. Addendum to the story, the next day, or maybe the day after the next day, a Ktsin Dover Tzahal shows up in our unit. Now the Dover Tzahal, the army spokesman, these were the men that we really didn't want to see. Because these were the guys who were usually responsible for investigating abuses of any kind by Israeli soldiers. And they come to our unit, and they're looking for the officer who was on duty the day before in Jabalia in this refugee camp. On such and such a patrol, they found out that it was from this unit. So I hear this, right? And I get a little, you know, right? Thinking, what did I do? What did I do wrong? There was a riot. Who did I hurt? Am I being brought up on charges? And that's like the dream of the reserve duty soldier. You just want to get home without any court dates. Turns out, there was a Danish news crew on a rooftop about 4 blocks away, saw the whole thing. Saw the riot, saw them goading us, saw, had an angle into this alley, saw this person sitting on the ground, saw a soldier hit him, I never knew whether how well they saw it, and saw the officer stop him. And they wanted to do an interview with me. And I said, fine, you know, I had to ask permission, it's a whole procedure, that's why they brought the Dover Tzahal officer. And they wanted to know why I stopped him and what I thought about it, etc. Now, needless to say, this particular interview never made CNN, but I think about that sometimes. I mean, if I had let them do whatever they had done, I don't know for sure that I'd be sitting here today. But this leads us to an interesting question. How do you make decisions? How do you make decisions? If the Torah is meant to be a lifetime process, if Judaism is meant to give me a blueprint for how to live my life, then somewhere within that system there must be a way to come to all decisions. And yet that's not so. Do I need to make decisions? That's not so simple either. So I want to share with you a perspective on this question. It gets a lot deeper, based on what I think the Torah has to offer. And I will tell you, by the way, that I owe a debt of gratitude to a Rebbe of mine from Yeshiva. He was actually the first Rebbe, the first teacher I had in Talmud in the Yeshiva that I came to in Israel. His name is Rav Bick, Rav Ezra Bick. And a perspective that he once gave over in a class is what led me to where, to what I'm going to share with you. You know, if you look in the Torah, what's the first thing that God tells a human being? What's the first mitzvah that's given in the Torah? You think about it. What's the first mitzvah in the Torah? I don't say mitzvah for us today. What's the first instance? Pardon? Oh, very good. Right? What does God say? In the beginning of Genesis, in the second chapter, you should not eat from the tree of knowledge. But that's true. Despite the fact I'm about to tell you it's not true, you're really right and it's true. Now that I've told you that it's true, that's really the first, that's a whole separate question, why the first thing that God tells us to do is something that we shouldn't do. I would think God would share with me a positive perspective. That's an interesting question for another lecture. But that's true. The first thing God demands of us as human beings is don't eat from the tree of knowledge. And that's true. Now I'll tell you why it's not true. Because if you look in the verses, in the beginning of Genesis, it says that Hashem puts Adam in the Garden of Eden, right? And he says to him two things. From every tree in the garden, you can eat. And from the tree of knowledge, good and evil, lo tochal mimenu. You shouldn't eat from it. Now think about that. What this really means is that God is giving Adam and Eve two choices. One choice, the more famous of the two choices, is to eat or not to eat from the tree of knowledge. Do I refrain from eating from something because God commanded me not to eat from it? But there's a second choice that Adam has to make. And it's interesting that this is the first thing that God actually says to mankind. Mikol eitz hagan achol tochel. I'll just find the verse so that you'll know where it is if you want to find it. It's in chapter 2, Perek Bet, and it's verse 17, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Zayin, chapter 2, verse 17. The first choice is Mikol eitz hagan achol tochel. You can eat from any of the trees. Now that gives Adam an interesting question. Because the next morning, he gets up, and he has to decide, what's he going to eat for breakfast? Seems like an interesting and a simple choice. Not so simple. There are oranges, and there are pears, and there are apples, and there are grapes. What do I eat from? Essentially, if you look at the commentaries, I'll tell you what the commentaries offer on this particular verse. But I want to share with you something very different. Commentaries, the Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, those of you on the tour the other day, you got a sense of who the Ramban is, so maybe it's a little more special to study it. He came to the Old City not so long ago, 600 years, 700 years, that's not so long ago in our terms, around here. The Ramban says essentially that before Adam HaRishon, before the first man, can make that type of a decision, can gain any benefit from eating or not eating from the tree of knowledge, he has to have the opportunity to choose. So essentially, God gives man freedom of choice. God says to man, you can do anything. The whole world is yours. Once I taste of that, once I know that the entire world is mine, that I can really do anything I want to do, well, then it's a little more difficult not to eat the tree of knowledge. And that may be true. But despite the fact that's true, and despite the fact that I will grant you that if there is no choice, then there's no value to my decision making, I still want to understand something very important. How does man choose? How do you make such a choice? How do you make choices in general in your life? Now that's not a simple question. And it's interesting. When we're young, as children, choice is very simple. Right and wrong is very simple. Right is what mom and dad say, what Ima and Abba say. Till you're, I don't know, 6 or 7, yeah, my mother is surprised to hear this. I wouldn't have said this then. Till you're 6 or 7 years old. So, what Ima says goes. And whatever they tell you to do, that's what you do. Then you hit 7 or 8, you hit that rebellious stage, but there's still a way to find out what's right and wrong. You look it up in the encyclopedia. You ask your role model. You look it up on the computer. Is it always so simple? Can I really make decisions so easily? And I'll tell you something, it's very interesting. Because if you look in the Torah, it's almost as though from one perspective, we have a dilemma that the Bible, or the characters and figures in the Bible, didn't seem to have. When you look at the Torah, when you study it from this perspective, it almost seems as though they have it very easy. Because how do I know what's right and wrong in the Bible? Well, it's very simple. My impression is that right and wrong is determined by God. God comes along and tells Abraham, you got to sacrifice your son. So Abraham may find this difficult. Next week I'll talk about why God makes things difficult for us. But it's not as though Abraham intellectually has difficulty knowing what's right. He knows what's right. The question is, can he live up to it? If God tells you, if God came down here, sat in the audience, and said, you should stay and listen to the lecture, then you know you should stay and listen to the lecture. It'd be great if God could tell us what to do. As a matter of fact, at a certain stage in my life, I honestly believe that was the whole concept of a Navi, of a prophet. Because they had it really easy. There was such a thing as a prophet, and the prophet could tell you it's right or it's wrong. And essentially, all decision-making processes could be achieved through a Navi. I'll give you a great example. If you look at the beginning of the book of Samuel, Sefer Shmuel. There's a young man by the name of Saul. And King Saul loses his donkey. I could relate to this yesterday. I wasn't quite 100% sure if my car was stolen or if it actually lost it. You go through this bewildered stage and you're wondering if your car is somewhere else and if you're losing your mind. With a donkey, I guess that's not so difficult because you imagine that the donkey wants to get lost. So King Saul goes off looking for the donkey. Now, why the Torah is taking the time to tell me about King Saul's search for a donkey is an interesting question for another time. And eventually, at a certain point, King Saul says, you know what? This is dumb. Why should I go looking for the donkey? It could have gone left, could have gone right. I'll go ask the prophet. That's what he does. He goes to Shmuel, Samuel. And he says, listen, I'm looking for my donkey. Where's my donkey? So Shmuel says, oh, take a left. Great. Finds a donkey. Great idea. If I want to know, should I be a doctor or a lawyer? I don't know what to do. So I go ask the Navi. And the Navi tells me. As a matter of fact, there's a famous Ramban, the same commentary, which is generally quoted at medical school events because it seems to be a Ramban that is not too beneficial to the medical profession, which seems to imply, until you really understand it, that it's a tremendous lack of faith to go to a doctor. What do you mean to go to a doctor? I go to a Navi. Or I go to a Kohen, a priest. Something's wrong with me. And I say, what's wrong with me? And the Kohen will say, well, you spoke slander. That's why you have leprosy. Stop speaking slander. Yeah. And the leprosy will go away. Makes sense? That's what I do. I stop speaking slander. The leprosy goes away. That's a very interesting question. You think that we have no Nevi'im today, that we have no prophets today. It's not true. There are many people who believe that it's very easy to find a Navi. So I don't have an actual living prophet, a living Navi, so I make a Navi. Some people make a Navi out of their teachers, out of their rabbis. I don't know what to do. So I go to my Rebbe, I go to my rabbi. And I don't have to make a decision. Because I ask my rabbi. And my rabbi tells me what to do. I will grant you, he bases it on Torah. And by telling me what to do, I know what to do. So I don't have to worry. I was sitting once as an incredible Torah scholar, or mystic, whatever. It's a long story how I got to be sitting in this building and why I agreed to go. But his name is Rav Freund, tremendous Torah scholar. And for various reasons, as a mitzvah, I went to someone to get a bracha. To get a blessing. And I don't think this person would have gone on their own, so I went with him. And I will tell you for the moment, I'm not going to give you my opinion on this particular aspect of certain circles and tradition that you go to such a Rav, but I will grant you that if a Rav is a tzaddik, if a Rav is a righteous person, it may well be that they have a decision-making process that's worth taking into account. So I went to sit with this rabbi. Now this particular person was looking for a bracha. They were having tremendous difficulty having children. And I felt it would be a great source of comfort to this particular person to go to such a rabbi. I didn't honestly know inside of me whether it would make a difference. But sometimes if a person goes through such an experience and they have a different level of faith, perhaps it affects their psychological, there's a million different philosophies as to why to do such a thing, but okay. And this person was in a tremendous state. And I went with her to sit in this building with this Rav. It's not so easy as a woman to go sometimes if you have someone, especially if it's a Rav, and you can get in, it's easier, and I had an in, so I went with her. So I was sitting in this apartment building outside for God knows how long. There was a woman who was sitting there. And this woman I was with, and this other woman started talking, saying, why are you here, whatever. Turned out this woman lived in an apartment building. And she had X number of children. And it was a little crowded. And she had the opportunity to move into another apartment building a couple of blocks away, which has a little more room. But she didn't know if she should do it. So she came to ask the Rav, should she move? Should she move? What's the rent? What's the mortgage? Is there more room? Why not? Why? No, I want to ask the Rav. Now that's an interesting question. On the one hand, maybe that's a tremendous thing. What a level of faith. What a relationship with Torah. That I value the opinion of somebody who's studious in Torah so much that I will come to them for all my decisions. Tremendous idea. Or do you say the opposite? Poppycock. What do you mean, ask someone else for your decision? It's a healthy thing to make decisions. And the truth is that this is a much deeper question. But I want to understand this. How do I make choices? And I want to express to you that the Torah implies that there is a value in making choices. And the truth is that everywhere you look in the Torah, it's quite clear that this is so, and I'll give you a great example. Take, for example, the story of Moshe. Moshe leaves, first of all, the birth and the creation of Moshe as a leader. What's the first instance that we discover Moshe's character? Not Moshe as a person. Not the birth of Moshe. Not the upbringing of Moshe. But Moshe's first active role. He walks out. He's brought up as a prince of Egypt. He walks out into Egypt. And he sees an incredible sight. He sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating a Jewish slave. That's the birth of Moshe. And it says, Vayifen Kovako. He looks here and there. Vayar ki ain't ish. He sees there's no one watching. Vayachet amitri. He hits the Egyptian. What allows him to make that decision? There's not yet a system of halakha. And by the way, I'm not so sure that halakha would agree with that decision. To kill a person for hitting someone else, not so simple. In fact, if you look at it, Moshe's first contact with God at the burning bush comes about because of a number of decisions. His first decision is that he decides to hit the Egyptian. His second decision in a second situation, when there are two Jews fighting, is that he decides to intervene. And his third decision is to run away from Egypt. In fact, the first time we come into contact with Moshe in terms of his relationship with God, he sees a burning bush. You ever stop to think about that? What does that mean, to see a burning bush? I mean, if I was going to bring this is God's introduction to Moshe. If I was going to create an image for Moshe to see as an opportunity to come into contact with God, I would have made a burning mountain. I don't know, when I was in high school, Mount St. Helens, I think it was in Washington, blew up. You remember this story, right? I still have a little bottle of ash from Mount St. Helens. Some brilliant individual flew to Mount St. Helens, filled up 900 million bottles of ash, and sold them to all the idiots like me. But okay. And I have it. And this mountain blows up, and it occupied the news, and incredible, and the soot. Burning bush. It's the middle of the day, it's in the desert. How do you notice a burning bush? Very interesting. It has to burn for a long time in order for you to suddenly realize, wait a second, that's burning, and it's not getting eaten up. It's interesting that the first time that Moshe comes into contact with God is not this majestic display, but a very gradual process, a gradual appreciation. And Moshe says an unbelievable line, and this line will change the course of Jewish destiny. Asura na ve'er'eh et amareh agadol hazeh. I will turn, and I will see this thing. He makes a decision. It's hot. He might be dehydrated. Who knows what he's going to find there? He makes a decision. But I'll go even a stage further. Because when he finally gets there, and God has this whole discussion with him, and God says, listen, I want you to go down to Egypt. And I want you to let my people go. What does Moshe do? I would expect two words from Moshe. Yes, boss. When God came down, told you, go to New York City and set the people free. You'd go, because it's God. No. Moshe starts to have a whole discussion with God, a whole debate. It's incredible. It's mind-boggling. Moshe Rabbeinu, little Mo, is arguing with God. And the Torah is actually sharing this with me. I can argue with God. And finally, God, through a series of miracles, and perceptions, and arguments, convinces Moshe that he has to go. And if you look at the Torah, it's an unbelievable series of events. And God says, V'ata lecha v'eshlachecha el paro. Go, and I will send you to Paro. That's a very strange verse. This is verse 10. Pasuk Yud in the third chapter of Exodus, Perek Gimel. Okay? Chapter 3, verse 10. V'ata, and now, lecha, go, v'eshlachecha el paro, and I'll send you to Pharaoh. What do you mean, go, and I'll send you? I'm sending you to Pharaoh. Go. In order for me to send you, says God, you have to decide to go. And it becomes even clearer later on. Because after this whole discussion, almost a full chapter later, finally Moshe says, Shlach na biyad tishlach. If you decide to send me, I will go, which is in chapter 4, verse 13. And he still doesn't go. Because in verse 18 of chapter 4, this is a whole chapter later, Vayelech Moshe vayashav al yeter chot. No, Moshe goes back to Yitro, his father-in-law. And he says, Elcha na v'yashuva elachai. I'm going to go. I should go back to Egypt, my brethren. And again, God comes to Moshe. In verse 19, Pasuk Yotet, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe b'midyan. God comes to Moshe in Midyan and says, Lech shuv Mitzrayim. Go back to Egypt. Ki metu kol ha'anashim ha'mevakshim et nafshecha. Because all of those who are attempting to take your life have gone. They're gone. Now this is a reference to the fact that there were two Jews. He once stopped an argument. They said, we know you killed the Egyptian. Moshe leaves. They're dead. Whatever that means. That's incredible. That means that after it's clear that God has told Moshe that he has to go to Egypt, and after Moshe understands he has to go to Egypt, he still doesn't go. And God has to come again. And God has to offer a reason yet for him to go. Now that reason, according to the Midrash, makes a lot of sense. Moshe apparently feels that even though God, and the issue here is not whether he doubts God has told him this. It's clear that God tells him to do this. Moshe apparently feels that despite the fact that God wants of him to go, that he'd be putting his life in danger by going. And by putting his life in danger, well, he can't do that. So that's his own decision-making process. So God comes along and says, no. They're dead already. You don't have to worry. You can go. And then Moshe says, oh, okay, and he goes. That's unbelievable. Where did Moshe get the gall to do this? How does Moshe come up with this process of decision-making? What's clear to me is that Moshe makes decisions. And that those decisions are not guided by some black and white text. They are decisions that Moshe has to struggle with, and for which he will be held responsible. And I see this in every story in the Torah. God comes along to Abraham and he says, take your only, your beloved son, Isaac, and offer him up as an offering. In the place, in the place that I will show you. And Abraham walks for 3 days. And the Midrash tells me the reason that Abraham walks for 3 days is that you shouldn't think that it was an instantaneous burst of zeal that God says, come, Abraham! And Abraham says, yes, I believe! And he jumps forward, grabs the knife, and shechts his son. No. He walks for 3 days with his son, whom he loves, his only son. And he has to struggle with this process. And God doesn't give him a right or wrong. How do you reach those decisions? And I want to tell you, people make a huge mistake. And it's very important. You know, one of the things I like about this type of an audience is that there are so many different backgrounds in the same room. And so we can have so many different perceptions of the same thing. Sometimes people are beginning their exploration or re-exploration into Judaism. And I've actually had students say to me that the most exciting thing about Torah is that I honestly feel that I found a source which will give me the answers that I so seek. And people really believe if I study enough Torah, I will get the answer. And I'll tell you something. You don't have to look to beginners. When I was in yeshiva, when I was studying to be a rav, to be a rabbi, there are really people who believe that you can find every answer in halacha. I don't think it's true. Halacha doesn't tell me whether I should be a lawyer or a doctor. Your mother may tell you. That's a different type of halacha. But you will not find written in the code of Jewish law the Hayita doctor. It doesn't say that. There is the mother's rewritten version. I didn't actually suffer from this. My mother said, thou shalt be a rabbi, and I listened. But okay. How do you make such a decision? I actually once met a person, wonderful fellow, and he had there was something about him. There was a certain nervousness, a certain uneasiness I couldn't figure it out. And I came with him once into the lunchroom, Ed is right, and he was standing before the table. There's we have a table, good food, come check it out. And there were a few different things there, and he was standing there looking at it. And you know, you don't notice these things unless you're looking for them. So I walk and I take some food, and I walk and I sit down, and then I went back to wash my hands or whatever, and I see he's still standing there. And he's looking back and forth at the food. And I said, is everything okay? Couldn't decide what to take. He was paralyzed by this decision. I never saw anything like it. And as I noticed this, I began to notice other things. Sometimes people have tremendous difficulty making a decision. Tremendous difficulty. The simplest things. What do I wear? I don't know. For me, there are two factors in the decision-making process as to what I wear. Is it in front of my cupboard? And is my wife there? That's it. There's nothing else to decide. Some people... 15 million different outfits, and does this one go with that one, etc. And God forbid, it's a wonderful thing if you're doing it from the right perspective. I want to look nice, etc. I can't look that up in the halacha. And people think, I can make that a navi. That's my navi. That's my prophet. I'll find the answer in the code of Jewish law. And if I can't find it in the Shulchan Aruch, I'll find it in the Mishnah Berurah. If I can't find it in the Mishnah Berurah, I'll find it. And worst comes to worst, if it's not on the computer at Bar Ilan, which is a whole computer of responsum, So then I'll look in the Shmirat Shabbat Kilchata, which is a law which will tell you what to do on Shabbos, and I'll find my answer. Who says you always find the answer? How do I make decisions? Now, in order to give you a response to this, and I think that this is one of the most deep questions that we can find in Judaism, and in general, how do I arrive at the conclusions of my life? I have to ask you a different question. And I honestly believe that this is one of the questions that is at the root of some of the deepest difficulties that we're experiencing today in Israeli society. There are two concepts. In the Muslim movement, you can find them. The Muslim movement, which was a movement which really took force in the 1700s, at the behest of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, although he wasn't the one who started it, probably started by Abraham, but okay. It's called the Muslim movement. Muslim means ethics, the ethical movement. And it was really a movement which believed that we were spending so much time studying the letter of the law, we were losing the ethics behind the law, and a person should work on him or herself to develop character traits. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to say, it's easier to learn the entire Talmud than to change one character trait. And that's very true. There are two different concepts, which at first glance, seem to completely contradict each other. The first is bitachon, what you might hear in yeshiva circles as bitachon. Right? Somebody says bitachon, don't think it's a part of your car. It's actually a whole Jewish concept, and it means faith. You should have a little bitachon, have a little faith, bitachon. It's very interesting that the modern Israeli word for security, right, bitachon, is the same word that the traditional Judaism uses for faith. Maybe some people believe that security is my faith, and maybe some people believe that faith is my security. But the whole concept of bitachon is essentially that you should have faith. In any situation or under any circumstances, that really there should be no such thing as fear in this world. As the song goes, famous slight misquotation from Rav Nachman of Breslev, Kol ha'olam kulo gesher tzar ma'od, the whole world is a narrow bridge. Ha'ikar lo lefached klal. And the main thing is to have no fear at all. It's a very difficult pasuk. Maybe I'll talk to you about it if anybody shows up on Thursday night, but it doesn't make a lot of sense that you shouldn't have fear. I'm not so sure that's true. It's much more powerful to say that even if you do have fear, that you do what you have to do anyway, but that's not what Rav Nachman said. So that's for another time. But essentially what that means is, of course you should have no fear. If you knew that there was a God, and if you were convinced that God had it all planned out, then how could you have fear? There must be a reason for it. And whatever will work out for the best. And if this event, whatever it is meant to be, then it's meant to be. But that's bitachon. As a matter of fact, this is one of the difficult questions. Why should I go to a doctor? There are movements, not Jewish movements, but there are movements, religious movements, that honestly believe that it's blasphemous to go to a doctor. Because if God is the master of all, and if God controls all, then if a person is ill, it's because God wants them to be ill. And to attempt to change that is, after all, a blasphemous act. You should have faith. If this person is meant to die, they'll die. And if this person is meant to live, they'll live. And who are you to assume that you can have effect on that person's health? How can you affect that person's health? You don't affect anything. God affects everything. And even if you do go to a doctor, it's just an illusion. And we know that this is true. People with very ordinary diseases, and doctors can't find a cure. People with diseases that should have no cure, and they get up and walk. So that's the essence of bitachon. Now you can take this essence to an extreme, and I would challenge you, why not? I'm driving my car, and I discover one morning I have no brakes. I have to get to the synagogue to give a shiur, to give a class. So I should say, well, I'm going to do a mitzvah. I have complete faith. God doesn't want me to get there. It won't matter if I fix the brakes. Now, I want you to know this is great because I could save a fortune this way. I should have bitachon. Why wouldn't you walk through Harlem in the middle of the night? I mean, if God... Don't anybody assume I'm suggesting this. I'll get in a lot of trouble. But why not? If God wants you to be where you're supposed to be, you'll get there one way or another. Everything is for the best. Then there's another idea. The other idea is the direct opposite. This idea is something called hishtadlut. In the yeshiva world, they called it hishtadlus. Lehishtadel is to try, to make an attempt, to struggle. Hishtadlut says that I should be struggling to make things better, to make things work, that I should attempt to affect my own destiny. They tell a famous story. I believe it was Rav Lapian, who was the Mashgiach in a yeshiva in Kfar Chasidim. He was a tremendous Torah scholar. He wrote a tremendous sefer called the Lev Eliyahu. It's a magnificent book. It's been translated into English. They say that he used to buy a lottery ticket every Friday. You know, there was a yeshiva bacher from one of, I think it was from Panovich, yeshiva bacher who won 8 million shekels in the lottery, a few years ago. This was like a big thing, you know, the yeshiva world made it. You see, you know, God, tremendous, right? Of course, somebody thought to ask, wait a second, why are you playing the lottery? But okay. And if I give some money away to this person or get some more money that way, it's not going to really make a difference. The Chafetz Chaim used to say that there's a decree how much money you're going to have in your life and how much money you're going to have in a year. And it doesn't matter. You think that you control how much money you earn. But really, whatever's supposed to be is supposed to be, and it has nothing to do with what you do and how many hours you work. So if you work a little more, so you get your money that way. And if you work a little less, you get your money that way. Whatever it means. That being the case, he says, you know, I teach in yeshiva. And really, I don't work. I teach Torah. And they give me money. I have to do something to earn my work. So I buy a lottery ticket once a week, and that's my cover. Hishtadlut is really a cover for God to work His miracle. You do your bit, then God can do His bit. It's sort of an extreme version of Ein Somchin Al Hanes, you don't depend on miracles. You shouldn't jump off the Empire State Building and say, if you love me, save me. Because then Judaism believes you're an idiot. And that makes a lot of sense to me. But how do I fit that in the realm of Bitachon? How do I balance these two ideas? And it seems as though when you look in the Torah, I find examples of both. How do I balance the two? And the truth is, when you think about it, that this is one of the oldest paradoxes. In order for me to make any decision in my life, when you think about it, I have to pretend that God isn't there. Because if I really knew that God was there, then I would understand that my decision has no value. Because I'm not really deciding anything. So it's almost arrogance to assume that I can affect the decision. So I have to pretend that God isn't there to make a decision. And yet that seems to be what God wants of me. How do I understand that? So I want to tell you a very deep idea. In order to understand what bitachon means, what is real faith? Real faith is not trusting that God will do it for you. It's trusting in God. Those are two very different things. Real faith is accepting somehow that Hashem has a will and that I'm willing to accept what that will is. But there's a catch. You see, in order for me to assume that God will work it out for the best, so that it'll work out well for me, you have to have a certain amount of arrogance. What gives me the right to assume that God's going to do anything for me? What have I done to earn that assumption? What gives me the right to assume that God is willing to work things out in my favor? That's what Hishtadlut is. Bitachon, faith in God, is not a vacuum. It's not a contradiction to Hishtadlut, to an attempt to struggle with reality. It complements it. It's Hishtadlut, it's my attempt to affect fate that gives me the right to assume that fate will affect me. It's a partnership. When I struggle with an issue, by virtue of that struggle, I earn the right to say that I've done my bit. And I'll tell you what verse in the Torah expresses this better than any other. In the beginning of Bereshit, God says an unbelievable thing. He says, Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmeinu kidmuteinu. Let us make man in our image. And the rabbis have a field day with this verse. What does that mean, let us make man? What does that mean? It makes no sense. Who else is there that God's talking to? So you can imagine 10 rabbis, 11 opinions. It's the angels, it's creation. Rav Soloveitchik has a tremendous idea. Soloveitchik was the Rebbe of my Rebbe. I had the privilege to hear him a few times. He was without a doubt perhaps one of the two greatest thinkers of our modern generation. He passed away a number of years ago. tremendous Torah scholar, arch rationalist, says an amazing thing. He says, when God says, let us make man, God is talking to man. God is saying to man, let us make man. I've made a world. And in that world I've put you. But the world isn't finished. What are we going to make of it? See, if I gave you a world that was all finished, what would there be to do? So I've left this world unfinished, and I give you an opportunity to make of it what you will. Now that's an incredible gift. It means that every morning when I wake up, I'm recreating. It means that every day I have the opportunity to recreate the world, my perspective. What will my world be? If the Talmud says, "Kol ha-matzil nefesh achat mi-Israel ke'ilu nitzil olam aleih," if you save a human being, a human life, you've saved the world, that's really what it means. I am a world. And it would be arrogant to assume that I am all there is in my world. But Hashem allows me to share with Hashem the partnership of that world. We together make this world. And that's the partnership. If I struggle and do my bit, God will do God's bit. And I want you to understand something. If this is so, then what that means is that I have to attempt to struggle with my decision with all the means at my disposal. It doesn't, by the way, necessarily preclude going to a rabbi for advice. If you're going to a teacher or a rabbi or a doctor, whoever it might be, who you think is an incredible authority, who has tremendous insight, and that's part of your decision-making process, and that's valid, because I have to use all the means at my disposal to come to a decision. What it does mean, however, is that I have to take responsibility for my decision. It's not the Rav who's making the decision, I am. And I'm responsible for it. And I'd be a fool not to take into account what that Rav has to say, any more than I'd be a fool not to take into account what the doctor has to say. But ultimately, I struggle with these decisions. And it's a good struggle. It makes life worth living. It makes life meaningful. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I have to feel at the end of every decision-making process that I've done my best to struggle with it, to weigh it, and to come to the best conclusion I can find. And at that point, and only at that point, can I say that now, having come to that decision, I can have faith that that decision is the right decision. Even if I make the wrong decision, I have no way of knowing if I've made the right decision. But if I do this partnership, if I take it seriously, if I take responsibility for who I am in this world, if I struggle with every decision and put everything into it, then I can have confidence, says the concept of Bitachon, that even if that decision is the wrong decision, it'll be the right decision. And this exists in a myriad of opportunities. You have I'll give you an example. 8.5 years ago, I was still a happy bachelor, and I was living at 59 King George Street, which is where my parents still live. They actually thought it was their house, but I knew different. And I got a note on the door from my brother that there were two things going on that particular night. There was a party out in Tel Aviv for a good friend of ours who had just gotten engaged, and all our friends were going to be there. And there was also some party that a girl who I knew was throwing for someone who just come back to Israel. She was visiting for 6 months. Her name was Dorit. And I remembered her from like 5 years ago. I thought she was kind of cute. But this was a really good friend of mine, so I had a decision to make. And I wasn't sure what to do. I felt bad. Shouldn't I go to the engagement party? He's a good friend. So I struggled with this decision for about 30 seconds. She was really cute. And I went to the party. It was around the corner. And today she's the mother of our three children. And the truth is that that seemingly minuscule decision affected the rest of my life. Now, I don't know that I made the right decision. If I'd struggled with that and I'd ended up going to Bar Ilan, maybe that would have been the right decision. In fact, very often I have no way of knowing whether I made the right decision. In fact, I would go a stage further. Once you've made a decision, you can continue to make it the right decision with your outlook and your perspective. And that's very important. I had a wonderful job in a frat, teaching in Yeshivat HaMiftar, Bravenders, very fulfilling job. It was a year program, working with students who were attempting to struggle with Jewish text, many of them beginners. I found it very fulfilling. It was a good salary. It was around the corner from my house, so I could also spend time with my family. They were offering to double my salary. They were offering all sorts of things. And then this little guy with a red beard in a place in the old city says, listen, you know, you've been teaching here, I don't know, why don't you come work for us? It's true you'll have less of a salary. It's true that you'll schlep every day for an hour and a half each way, but you'll have a lot of fun. And you have to make a decision. Now, believe me, that was a very difficult decision. I had long talks with a lot of people whom I have great respect for, including Rav Riskin, who offered me the other job. And the most difficult thing, at least I thought, what would be the most difficult thing that I would have to do in the end was to go to tell Rav Riskin that I decided to take this job. And I remember feeling that day, how do I know that I've made the right decision? Because I struggled. Because if you struggle with a decision, and you think it through, and you honestly believe that your motivation is right, then you can make it the right decision. And whatever's meant to be, so if you take the wrong decision, Hashem will work it out that it's the right decision. I make a decision to go to somebody, asked me recently to marry them, I made a decision, I'm going to go to their wedding, I'm going to marry them, it's a tremendous privilege, but how do I know I made the right decision? I don't know I made the right decision. There's no way of knowing. In fact, it could be the wrong decision, but if I did what I was supposed to do, it'll be the right decision. That's bitachon. Now what's... And we're almost done. Or we're almost beginning. What's the bottom line? If my idea of faith is that I go to my Rebbe, and he makes the decision, then I've done exactly the opposite. That's not real bitachon. That's not real faith. Because I don't have the right to have faith according to that. He has faith. Because that Rebbe is struggling with the decision. But I've done nothing. The process of faith is not a vacuum. The process of faith is something that I arrive at through my struggle with the world around me. That's the meaning of bitachon. And I will give you one last example, and with this I will leave you as food for thought. You look around you, what's going on today in our world? And we are living in an incredible experiment. Almost 5 million people, over 50 years, have come together to do something that is really, on paper, completely absurd. To take a desert full of swamps and to turn it into a modern country. To create a homeland for the Jewish people. So what if there are, you know, what is it, 800 million Arabs around us? So, no, 800 million, 5 million, all right, millions. So what if you can't even find it on the map? So what? In fact, all I really need is faith. We went on a, some of you were with me, we went on a tour yesterday in the old city. There's a yeshiva called the Shari Shamayim Yeshiva. It was the Haganah headquarters in 1948 in the old city. The fighters, the forerunners of the modern Israeli defense forces, sat in a yeshiva of mystics defending the city. And I asked the people who were on the tour a very simple question. Who was defending them? Not an easy question. If I want to have faith, you know, it's very difficult. You read the newspaper sometimes. I'll be honest with you. I don't think there is really such a thing as a chiloni. I don't like the term chiloni. It means secular. And the word chol, profane. But I don't think there exists such a thing. And I'll tell you why I don't think there exists such a thing, certainly in this country. Because if you read the newspapers, there shouldn't be anybody else here but people with kippot on their heads, if that's how I define religion and you know I don't. You read the newspapers and it just mentions something, I don't know, Syria has chemical warfare plants, Iraq has Scud missiles with biological weapons on them. We are outnumbered, it's unbelievable. I don't know what we're still doing here. And I would expect, I see a headline, that they've developed long-range Scuds with chemical warfare that can hit Haifa. I expect the next morning to find Haifa empty. Why would you stay in Haifa? They're mad. What for? There has to be something very deep inside. But I want you to know the faith that comes of hishtaglut, the faith that comes of struggle is a much deeper faith. I once spoke with another educator with a very different philosophy of thinking. It's not for me, God forbid, to say he's wrong, but we have different perspectives. And he very much believes that you can prove that there's a God. I don't agree. I don't think that that means that you can't know that there's a God. There are many things that we know in life even though we can't prove them. I know what love is. I love my wife. I love my children, but I couldn't prove it to you. He says, okay, you can prove that there's a God. And I'm familiar with all the arguments and all the discussions, and I used to be of that opinion myself. It took me a long time to grow up, because I've let myself give it away. But can you prove there's a God? Can you not prove there's a God? I said to him, you know what my biggest problem with proving God is? A student comes into my classroom, and let's assume even that I could prove to them that there's a God. How could there not be a God? How do you deal with good and evil? What is my purpose in the universe? How did we get here? All of the standard discussions. And let's say that a student actually sits in my classroom and after 2 hours, 8 hours, 20 hours says, wow, there's a God. How meaningful can that God be to them? They didn't do any work to find him. I did all the work. So I've taken God away from that person by giving it to him. That doesn't mean anything. And I'll tell you something else. One last story. I can't tell you how many times I had this thought process when I was in the Army, but I remember this particular night. I was an officer on patrol in Lebanon. We were doing a ma'arav, an ambush. You go out in the middle of the night, and you find a vantage point overlooking a valley where there's intelligence, the terrorists might be coming through. This is, I don't know, 1984. It was the middle of the winter. There's a whole procedure. You go out on a patrol, you have to go far enough from base so you're not endangering base. You have to find a hilltop that isn't saruf, it's not like burnt. They don't know that you lie there every night, so you have to change it. This particular night we were going to a new hilltop. I'd never been there before in an ambush. You're taking 8, 9, 10 men with you. You're responsible for them. You have all this gear on. About a kilometer away from the site, you stop, you drink water, you do whatever you have to do because you don't want to make noise when you come close. You put on your winter gear because it's the middle of the winter and it's freezing, but you don't walk with it because then you'll sweat and you'll get sick later. You get all your gear ready, and then you walk real slow and real quiet up to this ambush site, and you lay down on ambush. And it's called a star ambush. Star ambush means that you lie in the form of a star, and you set up quadrants, and every person takes a different zone. And if I'm taking from here to there, then the next person taking from there to there, so that there are two people covering every spot. And the real challenge is not whether you're going to find terrorists, but how to stay awake, etc., 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 etc. And it's not like in the movies. There's no music in the background. And it takes longer than 60 seconds. And you lie there for 6, 7, 8 hours. Today they do ambushes for hundreds of hours. They take a spot and they lie there for a week in turns until somebody comes through. It's unbelievable. We don't appreciate what people are giving up so that we can sit here out in the north. It's just incredible. And we're lying there in the middle of the night, and there's no quiet like the quiet of an ambush. And there's a drizzle. It starts to drizzle. Of course it starts to drizzle, because you're out in an ambush. Why wouldn't it drizzle? And there's this little puddle that's developing right where I'm lying. And you're lying on the ground, and you're kind of like, you know, you have to keep your, you sort of come up with all sorts of devices to keep your neck from breaking while you're doing this. And you have your binoculars and your night scope, and you're looking around, and you don't lose your night vision. And this little dribble of water from this drizzle is sort of making its way down and starts to go down my shirt. And I'm lying there in the puddle, and I suddenly realize that there's water pouring down my shirt. And it's 2 a.m. in the morning, and I got 2, 3 more hours. And I try to move away a little bit, and then I realize that I'm moving in mud. And I suddenly realize to myself, what is wrong with me? I mean, I was supposed to be in Columbia University, doing pre-law, life would be good, living on the west side of New York City, I was going to get a motorcycle, it would be great! And what am I doing? I'm lying on a hilltop in Lebanon. I had a letter in my pocket from a friend who had just finished, well, she was in her first year, I don't remember, Yale University, she just got in a car, got straight A's. I think to myself, what am I doing here? That's a very difficult decision. But I will tell you this. The relationship that I have with this land is a relationship born of struggle. See, what I was doing lying on that hilltop was I was falling in love with this land. And I appreciated this place and this people and who we are and how we got here more the next morning than I had in a long time. In the middle of the night on that night, the night turned into day, and a whole unit opened up fire on us from the right. And you got to understand, it's not like, you know, the movies, you know, dun, 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 where's it coming from? You're just lying there, and you're half falling asleep, and you're kicking your neighbor or whatever, and every 20 minutes you send a kick around, like, you know, everybody's foot touches everybody, make sure everybody's awake. And all of a sudden, you know, it's not like in the movies. It's not like, it's just, right? And I just like, whoa, somebody's shooting at us, right? So we freak out, we roll around, and you're supposed to do the standard thing and come out into a line, and you cock your guns, you're supposed to fire into darkness. All of a sudden, they started firing at us from behind. And I freak out, and I roll around, and I send my unit and my sergeant in back, and he's firing that way, and we're firing this way. All of a sudden, we realized what it was. It was December 31st. It was New Year's Eve. We were in an area of Christian Arab villages. How do you celebrate New Year's if you're a Christian Arab in Lebanon? You fire off all your ammunition. And the whole valley opened up, and they all started firing, and I don't know what. So we decided, since we fired back at their firing, that there was no point in lying in ambush anymore, so we went home. The battalion commander was never quite convinced whether we arranged this or not. What are you doing here? How do you develop a relationship with who you are? How do you find the relationship with whatever God is supposed to be? That's that struggle. And it's a sweet struggle. And if you struggle, if we try to find, if we throw ourselves into whatever these difficult questions are in our life, and we ultimately feel that we've given our best shot at attempting to come up with what we feel, for the right motivation, is the best response, then perhaps we can have faith that whatever it is that we come up with, and it's not just faith in God, it's faith in ourselves, because we're created in the image of God, that whatever we come up with will be what's meant to be. Listen, food for thought, and I hope, as Rat Hashem, that whatever difficult decisions lie ahead of us, and whatever thought process we're all involved in, that we'll appreciate not just the result, but the struggle.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.